Happy Wednesday. Why is everyone looking so dark, man? Somebody turn some lights out on this place. What's going on? Greg, welcome, man. I see that big smile on face. Dom, you freezing your butt off in Detroit?
Yeah, a little bit.
Everyone's looking so glum. It's like, man, it's summer. It's definitely the wintertime in most people's place, right? Rich is cruising along. And low attendance. Were we late on sending out the reminder? What's going on? Maybe everyone just didn't like my topic of discussion for today. Stevie, how are you, buddy?
Good, just sending out a second reminder right now, actually, just to make sure people got the first one.
Thanks, man. Sarah, we could do that too. Sarah's here. She left.
But yeah, it's good. It's just I don't know what's going on around in this house. We 2 days ago we had our Ash, our middle, started like projectile vomiting, and then this morning woke up and Van started getting it too. So we're wondering what the heck is going on. Poor little, it's crazy, man. Like you know this, like it's so scary seeing like a 6 to 8 month old get sick because like they puke and then they're like, oh, kill me, and their energy levels go from like 100 to zero. They just look lifeless.
Yeah,
It's
man. And you have this like this like conscious panic of like their fever is so high, should I give them something to bring it down or just let it, take its course? It's not an easy mental situation.
So he's been like a white rag doll the whole day. Just
Poor
he's
guy, man.
pulling around now. At least he's awake, but and he's given some
Yeah.
smiles, which is a good sign.
Yeah, man, it's never an easy decision, right? Because you're like, I want them to have relief. Like, I want it to relieve their pain, but the fever is necessary to kill whatever's there. So, challenging. Andrew, how are you, man? I just signed a client in Vegas, but I'll probably get you to support him.
Good deal. I'm good. Kind of the same thing. Two of my little ones getting over strep and just seems like it's going around, right? So all hands on deck, but yeah, things are good.
Very cool. All right. Well, welcome everybody. Mats, how are you? What's on your shirt? Is that like a fruit bowl? Always fresh, always original.
I'm good. Yeah. My daughter's in the same boat as the topic of discussion right now. So super interesting.
Jeez, man, everybody's sick. Man, I was talking to. We just hired, for everyone else listening, we just hired a guy who's a writer. He's basically an editor. He's written, so because you guys know I'm writing a certification, so he's basically taking my writing and turning it into, a course. And I was talking to him yesterday, 2 days ago, and he said, I haven't been sick in 50 years. I was like, wow, that's either really good genetics or really good health. Pretty incredible. So it gives us a standard to work toward. It's possible. And I'm always curious. Now this is a touchy situation, but I'm always curious about people's vaccination status and how that implicates in their long-term immune system, immune health. But so let's go back to this topic for today. So I think I've told you guys that a lot of my time and attention lately has been gone into developing the certification. And so I thought I would start today talking about muscle. And one of the things that I've changed my mind on in the last few months around how I approach muscle building. And there's not a lot of things in muscle building that I don't know. I've studied a lot, and at the foundation of everything, guys, how you move, mechanics is at the foundation of your ability to build muscle. So if you're having a hard time building muscle, if you're having a hard time feeling a muscle, if you're feeling an exercise in a joint, you can assume it's either the joint is very, very worn away, or you're doing it wrong. And so some people, it's very possible the joint is worn away. I know Prakash, you got a bad knee, and like chances are there's not much you're going to be able to do that's not going to hurt. So that's a different case. If that's the case, we probably need to see somebody to do something to support you. However, one thing I want you to think about is that muscles move bones, right? So when people think about like, oh, I'm going to go to the chiropractor to get my back adjusted, that seemingly lasts a very, very short amount of time because you're just adjusting the bones without adjusting the muscles. The muscle function is what determines its length, tension, relationship is what determines its position. So we have to say, okay, well, how do I make this muscle more effective at getting me into the position I want to get into? That's how we should start mentally framing this. And so if you imagine you're spending 23 hours a day, 23 and a half hours a day with muscles in whatever position they default to, getting that muscle to change its length is very hard. As an example, if I kept my bicep like this, if I just held it there all day, would that make my elbow stay in this position? Most people would say, no, that would be stupid. Well, it's the same concept when you say, well, you know, people tell you like stand up straight and roll your shoulders back, and like that doesn't do anything useful. Right. So how then do we actually change the orientation of the body? What I would call structural balance, right? I stand there like this, you know, arm palms facing you down at my side, structural balance. How do I get my skeleton to be stacked on top of itself? Because if it's stacked on top of itself vertically, that means the muscles in the front and the back and the side are not pulling it out of alignment, like a golf ball on a tee, right? We want all those muscles at 360 degrees pulling in an equal, relatively equal proportion. So nothing pulls itself out of alignment. So if I have something in the front that's pulling harder, well, that pulls that joint out of its balance, right? Does that make sense? We're trying to, these muscles are here on this side are too tight, so it's pulling this thing out of alignment. Well, most people go, well, this muscle's tight, I need to stretch it. Is that usually what most people think about? If they see the muscles kind of, if they see something's like, oh gosh, I'm, you know, I'm kind of hunched forward, this thing needs to contract or stretch. It's not always the truth. In fact, it seems seemingly is never the truth. What does seem to be the truth is the muscles that counteract that, its antagonist muscles, are not actively contracting enough. So these are lacking, the muscles in the back are lacking tone. They're hypotonic. The ones in the front are hypertonic, too much tone. And usually it's not a result of this one being too tight. It's the result of the one on the back not being active enough. So as you guys get into the gym when you're training, if you're experiencing something that's tight, quote unquote tight, that muscle is typically not the problem. And this is where most modalities kind of go in, seemingly, again, my experience, seemingly go wrong or go south is they try to act on the working muscle that's tight instead of trying to find the antagonist muscle and strengthen and activate that muscle. So really what's happening is the brain, we can call the central motor command, right? This primary motor cortex across the top of the brain is not sending enough signal to the backside to pull it back. And so stretching the front doesn't necessarily decrease the amount of central motor command to this side. That's, even though that would be a good thing, what we need to do is activate the opposite side. Is that starting to make sense for you guys? So when you start looking at your body, if you're just literally like, if you look at this, you know, like a skeleton, if you saw a picture of a skeleton here, skeleton might just like let it hang and there's no muscles attached. It just sits there. There's nothing pulling it out of alignment. But as soon as you stack a muscle on top and those muscles have different amounts of tone, then the muscle starts to pull the joints out of alignment. That's what causes joint problems. Okay, so if I want to start correcting joint problems, or if I want to start correcting muscular imbalances that lead to joint problems, I need to start looking at, well, what muscles are doing too much work and what muscles are not doing enough work, right? In this tug of war that muscles exist in, which is constant, every minute when you're sitting and standing and sleeping, there's a constant tug of war. One's pulling this way, one's pulling that way. They should be balanced. If they're imbalanced, you cause ultimately the structure, the absence of structural balance, the moving away from structural balance. So how then do we start to correct it? And Prakash, I'm glad you're here because this is very relevant to you. We have to start becoming aware of trying to identify the weak muscles and learn to contract them more effectively. Here's the catch. You can't do that by accident. It doesn't happen by accident. The body is going to selectively recruit the muscles that are strongest or most capable of moving you. And guess which ones are going to be strongest and most capable? The ones that are probably already hypertonic, because the brain goes, this muscle's got a lot of tone, use it. And you got to go, no, I gotta balance this out somehow, right? I have to learn to use these other this other group of muscles that isn't very good at contracting. They're not very good at being active. They're just kind of dormant. They're just kind of hanging out. So you have to learn to be the conductor, right? You're conducting the symphony. Your muscles are the instruments, and you got to learn to conduct the symphony. You got to go, you turn on, you turn on. And so exercise becomes exercise in mindfulness, right? How can I be so present that I can feel when specific muscles are contracting at specific joint positions, right? So my elbow at this position is different than my elbow at this position is different than my elbow at this position. I have to be aware of, including my shoulder, right? Like every different joint has a different relative muscle contraction signature at every different position. You could imagine me being here is different than me being here. It's a bunch of different muscles contracting in different ways. And I have to start becoming aware of what muscles are contracting in different positions. So, all that being said, here's one takeaway for you. The next time you go in the gym, I want you to pay attention to one really, really important thing. What joints changed positions? That. Start there. And how much do they change positions? So, here's an example. If I'm doing a row, I can do that row and I can pull the weight toward me, right? I can pull the weight toward me with this. You guys can see that. I can pull this toward me. Well, that's very different than if I do that row pulling this toward me, right? So the elbow changes less, but the bias the or the yeah, and but the shoulder changes more. Same exercise, different muscle recruitment patterns as an example, right? I could do a bench press where I press with my elbow versus one where I press with my shoulder. Different exercise. So I want you guys to start noticing on yourself and on other people in the gym what joint changes degrees the most on a squat or a lunge. Is it my knee? Is it my ankle? Is it my hip? Which one is changing the degrees most? And now I'm not going to tell you exactly to how to do it. Like, yeah, make your ankle move more, your knee move more, your hip move more. But what I want you to start becoming aware of is which one's moving the most, and is it the one I want to be moving the most? Because if that joint is moving the most, it's doing the greatest amount of work. Okay, so if your knee in a squat is moving more than your hip, that's okay. One, do I have the ability for it to do that? Like, am I able to go there with control and comfort and strength? And is that what I actually want it to be doing? Right. So if I want to be training my bicep, I want the elbow to be training to changing degrees most. If I want to be training my shoulder, I want the shoulder to be training degrees most, or my lat, I want my shoulder then to be changing degrees most. Right. So I want you guys to think about when it comes to optimizing the way you move, got to pay attention to which joint changed degrees most. Does that make sense? So here's what that
Can
requires
you
of you.
explain
Oops.
what you mean by changing degrees most?
Yeah, well, just what I showed you, Spencer. I don't know if you're looking when I did this, but
Yeah,
like,
I was.
so this,
Yeah,
if I'm
so
doing a
what?
pull down, if I'm doing a pull down, it looks like this.
That's
You
your
see how
elbow.
this changing degree, like that's
Yeah, your
straight.
elbow.
That's whatever, 90 degrees, right? This
Yeah.
is a big change. If I do this and I pull this way and the elbow doesn't change as much, the elbow stays outside of 90 degrees. That's a very different amount. Like the amount of closing of the opening and closing of the joint is degrees. That
Okay,
makes sense?
that makes better sense. Thank you.
So what does that require of you to start noticing? Well, you got to pay attention. So the first thing that I suggest everyone do when they get to the gym is becoming present inside your body. Right? So you guys can all do this when you're sitting here right now or standing there right now. Just like, what do I feel in my body? My butt against the chair, my feet against the floor, maybe the temperature of the room, maybe my hands on the desk or my hands touching each other. Like, becoming present in your body must be one of the first things you do in the gym. And so one of the things I like to do is I like to create a breath practice, and I become present in my diaphragm. Like, what does my diaphragm feel like? Can I move it? What does that feel like then in my back? Okay, as I breathe in, I can feel my back and my ribs moving. Okay, that's interesting. Now, what if I rotated and did that? What do I feel in my body? I'm trying to become more interoceptively aware. Interoception is the ability to feel what's happening inside of your body. And now, if we can do that, we can start becoming aware of, like, okay, when I put my foot in this position, I can feel like, as an example, well, everybody look at this. If this is my foot on the ground and I push through the inside of my foot more, like this, the ball of my foot more, I'm pushing this way versus pushing this way. That completely changes how the muscles fire up my foot or up my, in this case, my hand. If I push with the inside of my hand, it's a different firing pattern than if I put the outside, push the outside of my hand. Completely different. You may not even be able to notice in the beginning that it's completely different, but it is completely different. And I want you to just start bringing your awareness into the body and saying, hey, what is actually doing the work here? Start there, right? Start there with like, can I feel how when I simply change the way I'm moving, the way I'm pushing, how different things can actually contract? If I'm doing a tricep pushdown, I can push with the outside of my hand, the inside of my hand, completely different muscle recruitment pattern, right? And you have to decide, what am I capable of doing and what do I want to be doing? Because sometimes capability means this joint doesn't want to do this. Don't do that, right? Don't go to those positions. So you guys don't want to put your body into positions that hurt. If it hurts, stop. So here's where I'm going with this. You know the thing that I've changed my mind on that I said where we started? This is really interesting. So what I've come to become more aware of is the thing that makes us stop. Interestingly, there could be a number of things that make us stop, but oftentimes the things that makes most people stop is the total amount of sensory information exceeds what they're willing or able to tolerate. So the total amount of sensory information, as an example, if you put your hand on a hot stove, there's an enormous amount of sensory information going back into your brain, right? If you put your foot on a sharp tack, there's an enormous amount of sensory information. Your brain is trained to, when it feels an excessive amount of sensory information, it shuts down the primary driver, which is the central motor command. So if my brain senses an overwhelming amount of information, overwhelming amount of sensation, it stops. So when you're doing a leg extension and it starts to burn, first couple of reps, a little bit of burn. 8 to 10 reps, starting to burn a lot. 12 reps plus, this is too much for me, right? As an example, if you're doing squats, you start to accumulate a little bit of burn in your legs. I can handle this, but then what starts to happen? Well, now my lungs are burning. Now my lower back starts to hurt a little bit. All of a sudden, this total amount of sensory information is exceeding what my body wants to work through, and it stops. That's really interesting information. Does everybody follow me so far? Yeah. So when you're doing any exercise, it's actually seemingly most often the total amount of sensory information, sensory feedback that your brain is getting from your body, that's encouraging you to, that likely causes you to stop. So how then do we hack this system? So if you've ever meditated, you know that you can absolutely experience an enormous amount of sensation and not necessarily stop. Is anyone here a meditator? Like a regular meditator? All right. So when you first started meditating, for those people who have tried meditating and not succeeded, what's the reason you stop? It's exactly the same as exercise. You sit in a meditation and you're like, oh man, this is uncomfortable. My hips are hurting. My butt's hurting against the floor. My back starts to hurt. Gosh, this is uncomfortable. My knees are hurting. And you go, I'm done, right? Once you get past that point, you're like, oh, I can do this. You start to realize that you can forget about all those, that pain and that discomfort that you get in meditation from sitting or whatever. And you just move past it and it falls away. Well, exercise is no different. If you can learn to concentrate and meditate, you can move past those signals telling you to stop. Here's why this is interesting. Do you know that the feeling of desire can also fit into this category, feeling of desire? Have you guys, has anyone in this group had a desire in the last 48 hours to maybe eat something that isn't on your diet or drink something that isn't on your diet? It's just a feeling. It's a desire. It's a feeling in your body, right? It's a sensation. It's a sensory experience that your brain perceives. So when that sensory, when that sensation, that sensory experience gets too high or high enough, you do a number of one things. You either succumb to it, or you find some other way to change your sensory experience. Interesting. Or you maybe just let it pass. You're like, oh, it just passes, but it also passes. So this whole conversation around becoming consciously aware of our sensory experience minute to minute to minute is an incredible opportunity to change the way we look, the way we feel, and the way we perform. You guys with me? All right. What questions have you so far? Does this feel like it might become a useful tidbit of information for you? Do you guys see how you can start to use this to change behavior? Maybe you can start to use this to change your ability to do work in the gym, to change your outcomes in the gym or in your diet.
I got a question, Ben.
Yep.
So what if it's not a desire, but it's a habit that you used to do? So you don't desire it, but it's like it's like an old habit that you're still
100%, buddy. That's really great insight. So there's other things that drive behavior. It's not just desire that drive behavior, right? Habits drive behavior. Your environment drives behavior, right? Emotions drive behavior. All different types of emotions. But here's the thing, most often, and again, not always, but most often, habit is also driven by some internal feeling. So when you walk into your house or you walk into your bedroom or you walk into whatever, the habit is actually created or creates, chicken or the egg, some internal feeling, some internal, could use the word desire, could use some sensation inside your body. It's all about this sensory experience that we're having inside the body. So as an example, if you talk about a habit, like I have this habit of eating cookies, there's something that happens right before you do the habit that's probably some type of internal signal, which is a sensation. As an example, Prakash was telling me the diet that I prescribed for him is too bland. His wife has a hard time making it taste good. So, well, that's okay. I'm going to use it as an example. But like that's very normal. Your brain is used to having a very profound sensory experience. When you eat, you're used to having a lot of sensory experience. Like your brain gets dopamine from the palate, right? Which is fine. But as soon as you allow that to pass, it may take a day, it may take 3 days, it may take a week. As soon as you allow it to pass, your new baseline of required sensation from food goes down. Now, all of a sudden, you don't need it anymore. You're like, oh, you know, this food that I'm eating is so amazing. I get the same amount of dopamine that I used to get from this, what we'll call hyper palatable food. So as an example, if you guys eat cookies every day or potato chips or whatever, trying to go back to eating bland food is going to be horrible for the first 3 to 5 days because your brain goes, I'm just not getting the same sensation. I'm not getting the same experience. The brain wants more. And the brain, you go, sorry, brain, for a few days this week, you're going to have to not get what you want. And then all of a sudden the dopamine level goes lower. It's this idea of like a dopamine fast, right? If we just don't give our brain what it needs as far, or what it wants as far as dopamine, which comes from social media, food, pornography, all these things that that society is addicted to. If we just take it away, your resting level dopamine now becomes lower, or the required amount becomes lower. Now you don't have the same desire, or you don't need the same level of dopamine to satisfy your urges. That makes sense.
The receptors go dormant. The dopamine receptors start to go dormant, so you don't need as much to. It's kind of like the same thing with addiction, where it's why once an addict, always an addict. Those receptors are dormant; they're not gone. All you need is one blast of your drug of choice, and all those receptors come back to life. And the only thing that's going to make you that same amount of happy is the dope or whatever.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I don't know exactly what's happening mechanistically. But I would like just like testosterone receptors. So if you take exogenous testosterone, like hormones, you upgrade receptor affinity. And I think you're right in saying that like I don't know if you'll always, but for a long time, you'll have the upgraded receptors.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a distinction between pain and just an overload of sensory the sensation? Like, for instance, a burn, I can feel a burn, but I can also feel pain when there's joint on joint kind of
Yeah,
pressure.
I don't think your brain will discern. As far as what I know about pain, it's just feedback. So it could even be a pleasurable sensation, but it's just the total amount of tolerable sensation. So pain in your joint absolutely will contribute to why you stop. So if you're feeling a little bit of pain in your joint, you're going to stop. And so unfortunately that will contribute to like, yeah, I'm going to have to stop this because your brain senses it's afraid. It's like, oh, if I keep doing this, something bad will happen, right? It's a fear response. Yeah. So I don't think your brain will differentiate, Prakash, because I know what you're going through, man. It's not easy. And do you have images of your knee joint? Like, do you have MRI or ultrasound or anything like that?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Is it like bone on bone now?
Yes, no cartilage. Yeah.
What doesn't hurt?
What doesn't hurt? Just generally walking doesn't hurt, but there are times when I'm seated and I'm getting up after sitting for a long time. I don't even know whether my knee will buckle or not buckle. So I have to do it very slowly. I have to wait and feel before I do it. Yeah.
Yeah,
But I
and
can do a squat in, yeah.
cycling is painful.
No, cycling is not. Yeah.
So maybe that's just the solution, buddy. Like the goal is, we just need those muscles to do some work, right? I don't care if it's walking or step mill or treadmill. Like, I think honestly, walking's probably not going to be great for you. Can you do an elliptical? Do you have an elliptical at your gym?
Yes,
I think
I
we just
do.
stick with biking and ellipticals, buddy, and like just make that the standard across the board. Eliminate like walking. I think it should always be part of your routine, but it shouldn't necessarily be part of like if your walking mechanics are off, walking more is really bad for you. So I think we should just stick with the tread, or sorry, excuse me, the bicycle and the elliptical for your cardio. Like we can't induce more discomfort. The goal is just to get those muscles to work more. And I know we have to work on getting your feet to be active as well. I know you've got that leg challenge, so
Going back to your earlier point about identifying the muscles that are not activating, you know, the one. So how do you do that? I mean, now, for instance, if my knee, I know that it causes certain muscles to be more active than others, but you know, trying to identify the ones that are not activated is not easy for me.
Yeah, it's not easy because it's not common. I would say it's probably easier than you think. And so what I would suggest, it's a good question, Prakash. What I would suggest you do is anything you're doing, whether it be a squat, a lunge, a deadlift, a bicep curl, close your eyes for a second, either in the beginning of the exercise, the middle of the exercise, the end of the exercise, all of the above, and ask yourself what muscles are doing the greatest amount of work in this position, because you can feel what, like, where's the tension, right? Where's the tension as I move through this? Is it in my bicep? Is it in my quad? Is it in my glute? And then learn to direct it, right? This is why I said be the conductor. So if you, as an example, say you're standing up and you decide to squat down this far, like you're just going to bend your knees and your hips a little bit, stop and go, what do I feel? Where do I feel most of the tension? Like, I feel a little bit in my quads. I feel a little bit in my glutes. Or maybe I don't feel it in my glutes at all. How can I shift my weight so that I feel it more in my glutes? Oh, okay, there, I got it now. Okay, now I have a little bit in my quads, a little in my glutes. Now I'm going to go down this much more. Like, I'm okay. What do I feel now? Oh gosh, my quads feel so much more. Okay, well, do I want to feel it in my quads or do I want to feel it in my glutes? Maybe I can make them both do an equal amount of work. How would I position my body differently to make my quads and my glutes do the same amount of work in this exercise? Okay, great. Now I'm going to go down a little bit further. I'm just going to stay there. So, Prakash, this is all the stuff we do at camp. So, I don't know if you're able to come to Marbella in April, but we're going to go through all this stuff, man. By the time you leave there, I hope you're masterful at connecting with all of your muscles. Like that's really what we go through deeply, is like you're going to become positionally aware of everything, right? I call it mindful movement. It's like slow down, learn to contract in positions where you've never contracted before. And then when you leave, your ability to contract and build muscle is, I propose, will be exponentially greater.
Thank you.
Yeah, Steve or Andrew, anything you guys want to add to this conversation?
Yeah, dude, I was just thinking something actually directly related to what you're saying about like sensory overload, or, you know, based on where you are that day. Because again, Ruby's been sick, right? So two nights ago, I'm not even sure if I got 1 hour of sleep. Like it might have been, if you added up all the minutes, and I had to work legs. And so that was a really great experience of like that, but also like collecting wins and like celebrating different types of wins because I made it. But what I noticed is I was on my leg extension, and like I usually would like get to that place and then like, oh, it's starting. I've gotten through the garbage reps, now it's starting. And then like the pain happened, and I'm like, my body was like, you're just not going to do it. And I'm like, you're done. I'm working. And I'd be looking at my legs. I'm like, why aren't you going up? Like the second the pain was there, I would be there trying, but it just wouldn't happen. I'm like, that is so interesting. Hmm. It's really cool just to see that. So then I'm starting to think, it's like, imagine all the people out there who don't understand that they have an unintentional bottleneck holding them back from their progress. It's like a governor switch. Like they're driving like a Kia and they're trying to put the pedal down, but the car is like, I will let you go 120. That's it. And they don't know. Right. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And it's all just because of sleep, right?
Sleep, stress, inflammation. Those are your primary, I think those are your primary governors, right? So inflammation, because the inflammation has so much ability to shut down the nervous system. Stress has the cortisol has the ability to shut down the nervous system. And sleep, those are your probably three biggest culprits.
Yeah, and like those two things are gonna be heightened. So well, I think not just because of sleep, but they're all gonna do this like dance the whole time, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it's wild. This is definitely a cool experience and realization. But also it did give me that insight of like, and I know we're not really talking about gratitude training, but like it's really interesting that you can tie that back, because you can always look at some other way to win, right? Like I think Mike, our coach Mike, he said that. So he's like, what, some sessions are ball busters, some sessions are man makers. And he was like, you just look at a session every single day like a different way. And that was it. It's like this session's not about the gains today. This session's about showing up and proving what you got. And so you can always flip it on itself and just experience what you're there to experience that day, rather than thinking today has to be an improvement on last week's metrics, right?
Yeah. And I would say what I would look to, obviously everyone has different goals and at different places in their lives. And so what I would look to in that moment, me currently, is like, what do I need to do to get the greatest amount of output out of this session? So in this case, like if I would have been experiencing what you're experiencing right there, what I probably would have done is I need to find some way to fire up my nervous system, right? So you could do it with like, maybe you do a couple of sprints on the bike, or maybe you do a couple of jumps, or you do a couple of like aggressive claps, or you do like some loud music, or like, I need my primary motor cortex to turn on more. And it may do nothing, but I'm looking for ways to like hack the system, just because this is how my brain works. And like, I may get nothing. I may actually get less work, but my goal is like, I'm going to try to find some way to tell my brain to wake up. You know, maybe it's caffeine. Caffeine can work, drives primary motor cortex. Could be some, you know, Olympic lifting, like your stuff. Could, you know, whatever. We're looking for some mechanism of, I want to try to get the most out of this session. May not work, may work, but.
It's funny to that, because in these situations in the past as well, I remember with Miles, because Miles didn't sleep at all, right? Like he was Mr. No Sleep. And there was a bunch of times this happened. And my go-to, it sounds silly, my go-to is strength training. Like, cause if I'd go in there for like a hypertrophy session, I'd be like, yep. Oh,
you're done.
I couldn't connect. I couldn't contract. I couldn't do anything. Yep. So I'd be like, all right, I'm going to go lift something heavy. And I just work up to like a heavy weight. And then once I hit the heavy weight, I was like, okay, now I'm ready. And like the rest of the session was golden.
And so strength and hypertrophy, so that everyone, you know this, Stevie, but everyone else, are so mechanistically different. Like strength is driven by the brain and the nervous system primarily, right? And so that's going to be shut down differently than hypertrophy. Hypertrophy is going to be primarily driven at the level of the muscular system, primarily nervous system as well, but at the muscular system. So the muscular system requires hydration. Muscular system requires nutrition. Muscular system requires the absence of inflammation. So like, if you don't sleep very well, the likelihood of doing hypertrophy training is basically zero. but the not zero, but low. Whereas the possibility of doing strength training is still there. Yeah, so Mats just made a comment. He's like, for anyone who doesn't feel like legs and on the doing legs in the next session, jump on the Stairmaster for 10 minutes. And after you start sweating, the blood is pumping, you'll be more inclined to go blast. That's true. And I would say the way I like to do it is I would do 5 to 10 minutes on the step mill with no weight. Then I would go grab 20-pound dumbbells. Not something that's like uncomfortable, just enough to make it like I feel this. And then I would do 5 minutes like that. And then I would go up another 5 pounds, do 5 minutes like that. And I try to like, because there's a certain point where the nervous system is fired up and you're like, yep, I'm ready to go now. Otherwise, it feels like you're trudging through mud. Anyone have questions on this? Josh, what you got, man? And Josh, I appreciate you giving some feedback on my chimichurri recipe, man. I'm definitely going to try the baked fennel, or not baked, but I think you said pan fried or something, right?
That's what I'm here for, man. Try to keep everybody fresh with recipes and stuff. Yeah, I'm just laughing at Mats replying back to you. Ben and these guys always coming with the hard stuff for sure.
And not always, man. Sometimes it's just like, it's not hard. It's like looking for the simplest way to get the most of your system that day. Dude, there's days when I'm like, I'm fucking not feeling it, man. I'm like, I don't want to do this. You look for ways.
Yeah, that's super, super helpful. There's definitely those days, right? I mean, especially everybody, some of us are older, but I have young kids, and yeah, there's those mornings where it's like you don't get enough sleep and you don't feel like you have it and you still go do it. But some of these tips are really nice to kind of get your, as you said, kind of trick the brain into getting what you want.
Yeah. And I'll say this, guys, one thing that is probably the biggest, call it override, like the biggest hack, food. You know, I don't ever feel tired and be like, man, I didn't eat enough today, or I'm hungry, or like, you know, I didn't eat enough yesterday, I don't want to go train. Food is never, almost never the problem. Food is almost never the problem. Do you know the biggest hack? Hydration. If you guys wake up in the morning and you feel like shit, drink 2 liters of water and take a bunch of sodium. Do that. Like, you're like, oh, I need to eat before I train. No, you don't. You need to hydrate before you train. Drink way more water than you want to and take way more sodium or electrolytes. And I guarantee your workout will be better than if you had a meal. I mean, food can drive it sometimes, but almost for most people, water is a way bigger lever. Water and caffeine is usually much bigger levers than food. Food can be a lever if you're very glycolytic, but most people are not very glycolytic, which just means the energy system that your body tends to prefer.
And in this case, is it true that it would be actually the food intake from the day before versus the day of?
Yeah. Like people think, oh, you know, I haven't eaten, so my muscle glycogen and my liver glycogen is depleted. It's not. It's there. Like your liver glycogen, your muscle glycogen is probably, unless you've been fasting for multiple days, that's different. But like, if you've eaten any semblance of a normal diet, like it's almost never the absence of food or the absence of energy that's the problem. Yeah. Questions, comments, feedback? Andrew, anything to give on this one?
Ben, I was going to have you pick on Keith a little bit. He's dealing with a little bit of his shoulder. I feel like he's sitting there looking at his desk. So
I love to pick on Keith. Keith,
yeah,
what's going on?
If he wants to talk through it a little bit.
Yeah, of course. No chance to get away here. Well, where to begin? There's a number of things I was waiting for you to pick on me for, Andrew, to be honest. I've got bursitis in my left shoulder that's been giving me hell for, about probably a year now, but it flares.
Where and then feel it exactly? Back or front?
Front. Yeah. So that's kind of killing my sleep as well.
Did you get it assessed? Like someone said it's bursitis. Is it like,
yeah, I got an ultrasound done, and so they said it's bursitis in there. I've also done some damage to it just through lifting over the years and things, but now it's bursitis supposedly, so I'm going to go get a cortisone shot in there on Monday.
Don't do that, bro. Can you please not do that?
Really,
man? Fucking everyone I know that does that will tear that muscle inevitably in the near future. like one, it'll mute your pain for 2 weeks and then it comes back. And then you're going to tear that muscle. Everyone I know tears the muscle after cortisone shots. And I shouldn't say everyone, I'm exaggerating, but my clients, I have two clients who both torn muscles after cortisone shots. I'm like, fuck it. Can you get PRP instead? Can you get PRP down there?
Explain and I'll look into it for sure.
So if you can find a sports med doctor, all they do is they draw your blood out. They spin it in a centrifuge. They isolate the plasma. They draw out the plasma and they inject the plasma. You can do it yourself. You can buy your own centrifuge for like a couple. Don't do it yourself, but you could. I'm going to do it myself. You don't do it yourself. Where you can pull out your own blood, spin in a centrifuge, draw off the plasma, re-injecting the joints. And all you're doing is concentrating the growth factors because you have these growth factors in the plasma that are concentrated. You're just basically like you got injured. You know what swells up around injury? You're basically just accelerating the growth curve or the recovery curve. And it's remarkable for inflammation. Remarkable. So I would say start there, man.
What does PRP stand for?
Plasma rich platelets.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, I'll do that instead. But I think the other thing I was going to say is from there, I think that's kind of rolled into my sleep as well, because that's disrupted my sleep quite a lot, having the bad shoulder. And
in Australia, you can access BPC 157 for sure.
Yes.
You might be able to find TB4 as well, thymus and beta 4. Put both of those in a syringe and jack it in your shoulder 3 days in a row. And man, your shoulder's going to be, it's not going to be 100%, but it'll be 50% better. If you can find a doctor, are you in Melbourne?
Yeah.
If you can find, I can ask a buddy of mine in Melbourne. If you can find a doctor who will put the BPC and the TB into your PRP, that would be best case scenario.
So
yeah.
Got someone who knows something. That'd be amazing.
Yeah. Well, so Tony Doherty, who owns Doherty's, that's who I'm going to reach out to. He's got to know somebody. He may not, yeah, but
he knows everyone.
There you go. My father tore three muscles three times in areas when he had cortisone shots. Dude, it's everyone does it. Like, you just stay away.
Okay. Love it. Well, yeah, I think if anyone's going to know, then Mr. Doherty would know because he's very well connected. But I think, yeah, the other thing rolling on from it is just my sleep. And I don't know where we want to start the picking on Andrew, but I mean, for me, I definitely find like I'm a walking case study of how poor sleep is just. Like, I'm still getting my workouts in, but it's just, it definitely makes everything a hell of a lot harder. So,
is it because you're getting too much light exposure at night because you're on your phone?
Not really. I think it's just a lot going on. And it is having that. My biggest thing is having the pause time, is having the stopping, because I'll always find things to do. I'll always find things to keep my time. I put my phone away like half an hour, 45 minutes before I go to bed, but my brain doesn't stop. Throwing a 5-10 minute block in just to sit. Apart from the time I do meditation or a bit of breath work is rare. It's just back to back to back with what I'm trying to get done. So it's more my brain just burning as well. And then with the shoulder, the moment something like disrupts the sleep, my brain kicks off. It sees it as an opportunity to do more, think more, and those kind of things.
How much movement are you getting in throughout the day?
Plenty. Getting walks after meals. So two walks, then I do a 4-5K walk each night, and I go to the gym for a workout as well. And I walk to and from the gym.
Hmm. Any late stimulants in the day? Caffeine or anything?
No. Coffee stops at 11 a.m. So
where I'm going with this is like the primary trigger for sleep is the accumulation of adenosine, right? We have a few primary triggers for sleep, melatonin being one of them. So cortisol and melatonin are inversely proportional. So as cortisol starts coming down in the evening, melatonin starts coming up. That's the way it's supposed to work. Cortisol is triggered primarily by obviously stress, but also by light. So if you're getting a lot of light exposure, you could be suppressing your melatonin. That's one thing. The other thing that's triggered for sleep is adenosine. Adenosine accumulating in your brain gets this like sleep pressure. And I was thinking that maybe if you're not moving enough throughout the day to accumulate enough adenosine, you could be suppressing the adenosine accumulation, but sounds like you're doing right. Try some melatonin, man. Try some melatonin before bed. Don't do it every day. But some melatonin is controversial. Some people say yes, some people say no. I tend to lean to the side of like, if it's necessary, then do it. And so try like 1 milligram of melatonin, 1 to 3 milligrams of melatonin, and see if it helps. And don't and do it maybe 4 or 5 days in a row, or like do it a couple days in a row. If it helps, keep doing it for a couple of days, but max it at like 4 or 5 days in a row. And then maybe you can get kind of get back. Because if you just need a few days of kind of good sleep to get you back in the rhythm, maybe that'll be able to help you.
Cheers, man.
Yeah, man. Anyone else have questions? So someone asking about a frayed bicep tendon. Is that you, Lewis? Do you have a frayed bicep tendon? And it depends how badly it's frayed, buddy. Like I would say BPC, TB, and PRP would absolutely be the top line intervention, unless you can get stem cells. Stem cells, you'd have to go to the country for it. But BPC 157, thymosin beta 4, so TB4, and then PRP, a bunch of letters being thrown at you. But those are your best lines of intervention for sure. Depends how badly it's frayed. Here's a crazy story. I had both of my tricep tendons completely frayed. So like one tendon had just the outside of the tendon intact. The middle was gone. It was frayed. And the other one had a 4 centimeter gap in the middle. And I was like, well, I went to the surgeon. He's like, dude, it's inoperable. There's nothing you can do. He's like, we would have been better if you tore it off the bone. So I went to another guy and he did PRP and it healed them both in about 6 weeks. Great. I was blown away. Like my own plasma healed it. This was 2013, I think. 12 or 13. Long time ago. So I'm a believer. So guys, when Sarah sent out the notification with this call, we said we talk about longevity. And so if you listen to the recent podcast I released last week, I said I could be missing some, but there's about 32 different potential supplements for longevity, like things that have been correlated with longevity. I'd say at least 80% of them are not necessarily longevity supplements or vitamins, but the absence of them would shorten your life. Meaning if you don't have enough zinc, like there's a lot of evidence that says, hey, your cells aren't going to be operating well. You're not going to be producing hormones correctly. You're going to shorten your lifespan. Magnesium, as an example, will decrease function, drop or increase inflammation. So I don't know if you guys have seen that list of 32 vitamins. And again, I don't suggest you take all of them, but I suggest you start checking boxes and make sure, do I have enough of this dietarily? Do I have, or am I lacking this genetically? And if you're lacking these things, you should strongly consider supplementing with not all of them, but the ones that are the biggest opportunities for you. You guys want me to share that list with you? I also said that I would speak about, I talked about this last time, but peptide bioregulators. If you guys want to hear about that stuff, peptide bioregulators are just so unbelievably interesting to me. Why is this? I just reorganized all my notes and I messed it up.
I am very interested in peptide info.
Okay, man. We need to catch up anyways, Matt, but here we go. This is it. Okay, so I can find this list for you guys sometime soon. What would you hear? All right, well, I'll find this list for you. There's a URL that it's on the website. So here's the crazy thing, and I shared this before with peptides. I'll give you guys the 10-minute version. So Dr. Vladimir Kavinson, Russian scientist, discovered there's two primary systems in the body that are foundational to longevity. It's the pituitary and the thymus. And nobody talks about the pituitary and the thymus. So why would the pituitary and the thymus be maybe the two most important glands for longevity? Anybody want to take a guess? Pituitary and the thymus. What do they do?
Endocrine function and immune function.
Boom. Nailed it. Yep. Zach nailed it. So pituitary is the primary center for circadian rhythms, governed primarily, let's say, by melatonin. And so endocrine function and the thymus is for the immune system. So he decided that if we can optimize the function of the thymus and the pituitary, those are kind of these master glands in the body that if someone's dysfunctional there, everything becomes dysfunctional. So his primary interventions when it comes to peptides are going to be to support the pituitary and the thymus. So what hormone or what peptides support the pituitary and the thymus? Well, there's one called Epitalin, which is a synthetic peptide to support the pituitary. There's also another one called the pineleon. So we could support the pineal gland. So we have the pineal gland. I said pituitary, I meant pineal gland. So the pineal gland is in the brain. It's one of the primary regulators of all organ systems. So the pineal gland is regulated by Epitalin and pineleon. These are two primary peptides. The thymus gland is the primary peptide there is thymosin alpha 1, different than thymosin beta 4, thymosin alpha 1. So every peptide protocol should incorporate thymosin alpha 1 and Epitalin. Those are your two primary peptides, foundational peptides. So anyone decides to do a peptide protocol based on Vladimir Kavinson, not me, Vladimir Kavinson says those two should be involved in every month, every protocol. So if you're going to take peptides, he suggests you incorporate those two all the time. On top of that, he's identified 19 additional peptides. Actually, there's more than that, but 19 additional oral peptides that directly correlate to a specific organ system. So I can show you all these if you guys want. Let's do a screen share so you guys can see this. All right, so this may look like a mess because they're all linked out. But so as you can see here, you have A1 through A, well, it's actually A21, but they're out of order. So there's 21 different bioregulators, naturally occurring bioregulators. Does everybody see this? So we have A8 is for the pineal gland. It's called endolutin. A1, A5. So there's one for the nervous system, the muscular system, the testes, the thymus, cartilage, adrenals, the pineal gland, thyroid, kidneys, prostate, heart, retina, like lungs, bladder, bone marrow. So every specific organ system has a peptide that's correlated with its health. These are naturally occurring peptides. Now, here you've got additional ones that are synthetic peptides. And the difference from what I can understand is that the synthetic peptides seem to work faster. But the natural peptides are better over the long haul, meaning you're going to do these things kind of on and off for the rest of your life to support this. It's kind of like, if you guys have ever heard of like glandulars in homeopathy. So homeopathy is like they give you these very small amounts of substances that help to regenerate the tissues in the body. Well, that's what exactly the same mechanism that these peptides work on. They basically give you these really small amounts of the actual organ system itself, or peptides from the actual organ system, and it tends to regenerate these systems. With stimulation of the vase, also activate the system. Which system, Greg? Specifically, I can't hear you, buddy. You muted. Unmute yourself.
Basically, the same system that the peptides you're talking about, the pineal gland.
No, so the vagus nerve. That's a good question. So the vagus nerve innervates the organ system. It's not necessarily the tissue of the organ system, right? So you have the cells in the body have, or the systems in the body have different levels of organization. So the nervous system is one level of organization, but then you also have the tissue system and the cell system, and then the endocrine system, or the biochemistry. So you have these different levels of like organization in the body. So the vagus nerve, while it innervates all the organs or most of the visceral organs, it doesn't necessarily influence the cellular or connective tissue level of that system. So what we're trying to heal here is like the cellular signaling, which happens at the level of the DNA, right? Yep. So DNA transcribes every time a new cell is created in the body, the DNA creates it. And so these peptides work at the level of DNA, which is different.
That answers that. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Pleasure. Very different. While it's probably implicated, the vagus nerve is probably implicated in how well the body is able to transcribe DNA, because it's implicated in the electrical stimulus. So electricity is a really, really important factor in everything we do. And so the nervous system from the brain is going to determine the amount of electrical signal going into that organ system. So that'll determine how well it transcribes new cells or new DNA, but it doesn't necessarily give you the raw ingredients to create the new cells. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the fuel. Need the fuel.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So anyways, guys, I could spend a while on this if you guys want me to. The point being, I can send you guys some information on this. I actually just wrote an article that actually I can send you guys today, or maybe I'll make sure it goes on the website. You guys can look at the website on all these peptide bioregulators. I think it's just fascinating. And so a few things that I'm working on, I'm writing more blogs and I'm writing more newsletters that are really going to be deep dives on these topics. So if you guys, I'm sure you guys are already on the newsletter, but every Tuesday and Friday, I'm going to be sending out newsletters. Tuesday is going to be a deep dive on all these topics, or one topic. And then Friday is going to be kind of like superficial things that are interesting and exciting that I'm kind of working on studying or learning or applying. So I'm going to commit deeply into this newsletter, because there's just so much that I'm studying and learning that I'd love to be able to share with you guys in a format that's simple to consume, that doesn't require you necessarily being on a call or having to be here actively participating, although you'll have the option to do that as well. Coaches, anything you guys want to add? Okay.
One quick question for you, Ben, that might be applicable to some of our clients that are exploring this avenue of peptides potentially. How much more ROI would somebody get? And I don't know if you know the answer, out of, you know, introducing an exogenous peptide for their pineal gland, whether it be the natural one you mentioned or the synthetic one, when compared to, let's say, the top 10 things that that individual could do to naturally decalcify their pineal gland.
I don't know what the natural things are to decalcify your pineal gland. I don't think they exist. So
removing fluoride from toothpaste is like one.
It's not going to decalcify. It's going to stop the progression, right? So like, yeah, so it's hard to know, man.
Okay.
So right. Every peptide has a different effect on different system to help rejuvenate the system. As far as decalcifying the pineal gland, the only thing I've heard that actually does it is the peptide pinilion. That's apparently massively decalcifies. I've also heard that melanotan-1, not melanotan-2, but melanotan-1 can decalcify the pineal gland. How much of a difference? Everyone's got to be different. The one thing that I love about peptides is there's 50 years of human data behind it. That's interesting. Most of these longevity protocols and supplements have like one study on resveratrol that showed that it extended life in worms. You're like, that, what does that mean? Right. But these things have 50 years of data behind them, which is fascinating. That's why I'm very excited about it. Like 50 years of data versus like one study on fucking literally resveratrol is ridiculous. All the studies on resveratrol are done in C. elegans worms. You're like, why are we studying those? Like, there's obviously value, but it's definitely not the same as 50 years of human data.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I was just thinking more of like, if somebody comes into our community and let's say in the aspect of testosterone, let's say they get tested, their levels are at like 400, and that's not optimal. They want to get to 1200. Well, there's only going to be so much that they can do to move the needle forward to get naturally to get a response. But if the number one goal for that individual is to really just get to optimal at 1200, then they might want to just lean in on exploring TRT and, of course, doing all the other things, because, of course, you want to check off as many boxes as you can. But I think you know what I'm trying to say with that.
Yeah, I wouldn't think a peptide should be. It's certainly not a first-line intervention. It's a good question. It's not a first-line intervention. It's like a, I don't know, man. It's like I'm eating well, I'm training well, I'm sleeping well, I'm managing my stress, my relationships are in order, and now I'm just looking for some additional thing to push the needle a little bit further if I can. I wouldn't put them anywhere near, they're nowhere near the same league as a hormone intervention, or I maybe put them in the same level of as a supplement, maybe a little bit better than a supplement. Supplements are kind of like low leverage, but I'll say this, guys, I'm very eager to find solutions so that people don't have to take hormone replacement. Like, that's my one part of my mission is, like, I want to find ways that you're like, man, you don't have to take hormone replacement. In fact, I just got off a podcast with a guy who thinks, he's like, hey man, I think in 3 to 5 years, hormone testosterone replacement is going to be gone. It's like, we have other interventions now that are as good or better, and they don't shut down your natural production. Hormone replacement shuts down your natural production up to 95, so 90-95% across the board for everyone if you do HRT, testosterone replacement. There's ways now that we can replace, that we can bump our testosterone up to 1500 or 1200 without our shutting down our natural production. That's very interesting, right? Very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. And do you have any insights on, in this realm of introducing peptides for the pineal system or any of the other systems that you referred to, do you have any studies, or are there any studies that have proven like that the introduction of that exogenous method increases somebody's health span or lifespan by 5 years or 10 years?
Yes, there's an enormous amount of data measured through epigenetic testing. So epigenetic testing is the only objective way we know right now to actually measure lifespan or health span, right? So you basically can measure the life, quote unquote, lifespan or health span of the organ system individually. So you can measure like, hey, your heart is aging faster than your muscular system. Your brain is aging faster than your heart. And you can compare the rate of aging of each of these organ systems. And so what they're showing is these peptides can slow the rate of aging of the organ systems. So while it's not like if I take the testes bioregulator, my testosterone production is going to go up. That's not what they're saying. They're saying it's just going to decrease the cellular age in those cellular tissues. Yeah, so different, kind of a different intervention. So if anyone wants to look stuff up, look up Dr. Bill Lawrence, Dr. Bill Lawrence on YouTube, Dr. Phil Mikans, Mikans on YouTube, Vladimir Kapitsyn, you can't find much. He's the original guy. If you want to look up like PubMed, look up Vladimir Kapitsyn. But if you want someone to like teach you about it and like podcasting, he's not the guy. But you can find Dr. Bill Lawrence, will blow your mind. If you find him on YouTube, it'll blow your mind. Any questions before we wrap, gents? All right, everybody go enjoy your Wednesday, guys. Thanks for being here. Progression, enjoy your Thursday. Thank you guys for being here, and we shall talk to you again next week.